Okay, and this is Brad Schimmel, and I think we still have Matt Adamczyk on the line.
Yeah, I'm here.
Good, and Doug LaFollette is still here?
I'm here.
Good. Okay, then we will get through the quick routine business before we get on to our special business today. Did everyone receive, Doug and Matt, did you receive the minutes from the last meeting?
Yes.
Okay, I have them too, and I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll second it.
Okay.
I just got the agenda up on the computer, so I now can see it. Okay.
Okay. Any discussion about the minutes? All in favor of approving, say aye.
Aye, Doug.
Aye, Matt.
And aye, Brad. Okay. That's done. Then we have some loans that are in the packet for this month. Seen those? Do we have anyone that wants to make a motion relative to the loans?
I'm scrolling down to find them. It takes a while on the computer. As I remember, when I looked at it before, there was a whole lot of loans.
Yeah, I've got 13 of them this time.
Which is good.
They've all been reviewed by the Department of Justice for public purposes.
Yeah. So, I don't know if you could hear that, but Tia just remarked that all 13 have been reviewed for proper public purpose.
Okay, I've gotten to the loans, and I'm glad they're for public purpose. So here we are. There are 13 for about $6.5 million almost. Well, I'll make a motion to approve those loans.
Okay, I'll second that. Is there any discussion regarding the loans for this week? All in favor?
Aye, Doug.
Aye, Matt.
And aye, Brad. Then the loans for this meeting are approved. And then the fourth agenda item related to some approvals I did between meetings for agency expenditures over $5,000. Those are set forth in the packet, and there was some more detail relating to them that was in an email I think everyone got last week.
I don't think I sent that to everyone. I think I just sent the greater detail to you.
Okay. Well, we did have the tree seedlings at $5,100. I don't remember now what
GIS I can't.
Was.
Yeah, this is for our GIS mapping, and ESRI stands for...
I think it's just initials.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Which is why I haven't got it memorized yet, no.
Okay.
But it is a mapping software. It's an annual licensing agreement, and I guess ESRI is the company name.
I went ahead and approved that. We have to keep up our licenses for that. So
these are items that came up in the last 2 weeks?
Yes. And I already approved these expenditures.
Okay. Well, and under our agreement, you know, you were going to handle them, and if they seemed fine, approve them, and then we would get to look at them at the next meeting, which we just did. So
right.
That's good.
And then... We had our bill from DOA, and got to pay that or bad things happen. So I don't know that we need a motion. This is just informational. So
yep,
we have completed that. So we can go on to our new business, item number 5, and so we have some guests here to help us today. And
yep. Tom Hiddle is here from Sagawal Land Services, and Tom will be leading the presentation for us. I distributed an electronic version of the his PowerPoint to the commissioners a few hours ago, and welcome, Tom. I want to thank Sagawal Land Services and Tom in particular who invested a lot to prepare a very thoughtful presentation on timberland investment challenges and opportunities in Wisconsin, with a particular eye towards BCPA's unique situation. And I really appreciate the effort they put into this for us.
Thank you very much, Tom. As you go forward, do you prefer that that we just keep quiet until you're all done, or do you like questions as it goes through? It's your pleasure how you prefer it.
We can go either way. I'm fine with questions and discussion as we go through the presentation. I don't think it'll throw me off too much. But again, I would defer to how you want to handle situations here in your meeting. I'm afterwards. I can stay as long as need be to ask the house. So.
Okay. Thank you.
And Tom's worked for Steigerwald for, what were you telling me earlier, 30 years?
Yeah, just a really brief introduction before I get started. And I hope that Doug and Matt, you can hear me okay?
Yeah, it's pretty good. You're not quite loud enough, and I can't adjust this phone to be louder.
All right.
I'm moving it a little bit closer to Tom.
Careful. I hear everybody just fine.
Okay.
Maybe I have a better connection, probably.
If I tend to fade out or fade off or get tired or something, just let me know. And
don't let me near the projector. The last time I was near one, I started a fire.
Oh!
In the end of the park.
Okay.
Right, I'm not there then.
So just by way of brief introduction for myself, my name is Tom Hiddle. Been a forester in Wisconsin for a little bit over 30 years. John and I were talking about that earlier. I work for Steigerwald Land Services. I'm currently the senior vice president with Steigerwald, most recently the forestry and GIS operations director. So I do have a few folders that I will hand out. I have 10. I have hard copies of the presentation in the folder, along with a little bit more information on myself and our business. So those are available. My contact information and business card is also in there. Is really to provide the background information that hopefully you will find helpful in your discussions about the BCPO land. So I wanted to provide that background information. Just a little bit of an overview then for the presentation outline. We'll talk broadly about the Wisconsin Timberlands, including a little bit about Steigerwald and what we do. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the timberland ownerships and ownerships that we manage. And then we'll focus a little bit more in on timberland as an asset and some of the value components of consideration as an asset. And then I was also requested to provide some outlook for what the future for that part of our industry might look like. Secondly, we'll look at best management practices. These are management practices that foresters are engaged in on the ground on pretty much a day-to-day basis that are common and standard to the industry. Two broad areas there, the environmental side of things, and then more of the asset management part of the forestry spectrum. And then lastly, we'll look a little bit more in-depth at some of the PLN management considerations and challenges with comparison to some of the properties that we manage. And then I was also asked to address forest land management costs. A little bit more about Steigerwald then, very briefly. We are a family-owned business, have been in Wisconsin since 1957, started by Ed Steigerwald Sr. Ed Steigerwald Jr. on the left here is currently president. We were hoping that this would be a presentation that Ed and I could do together. We just couldn't coordinate schedules to make that all happen. So Ed's here in spirit. Currently, the business is being run then by third-generation Steigerwald Lee and Julie, COO and CAO. We have a staff of about 45 foresters, GIS specialists, appraisers, real estate specialists, folks working in the right-of-way acquisition field, and surveyors, I think, with offices in Tomahawk and Hayward. Our core part of the business really goes back to that history in forestry. Some of our staff in their office where they feel most comfortable, whether it be January and 20 below or July when the bugs are out. This is where they live and where they thrive. So to move on then, just a quick snapshot of some of the timberland ownership in Wisconsin for perspective. And what I want to highlight is the fact that we're going to focus largely today on this TIMO and REIT category, and we'll talk about what TIMOs and REITs are in a second, but that 594,000 acres is where a lot of my experience has been and a lot of where my commentary will come from. This is also, from my knowledge of this ownership and my knowledge of the DCP lands, DCPL lands, there are some similarities in the fact that these lands are assets often held as part of a portfolio. They are ownerships that are investment-orientated, where there are expectations for return. And there also are some fiduciary considerations and management responsibilities for the owners and the managers. So it's TIMO. TIMOs and REITs. A TIMO is a Timberland Investment Management Organization. That's the acronym. A couple of points to just highlight here. TIMOs work for clients that are interested in timberland investment. They acquire those timberlands as investments, and they actively manage those timberlands to achieve the desired results for their investors. TIMOs do not own land. They manage land, and they hire local forestry and property managers to assist in their management, which is where we fit into this picture. TIMOs began to evolve largely in the mid-1990s, not only in Wisconsin, but across the U.S. as well as globally. A factor of the diversification or divorce of the vertically structured and integrated mills from their land for a number of different reasons, but then also a little bit related to the ERISA Act that encouraged investors to diversify their portfolios. The monies that are going into TIMO's investing in timberlands as of 2012, about $45 billion. That's the number that has increased since. I don't know the exact figure. I've heard $50 billion. I'm not sure, but it is increasing rather than decreasing what I have heard. A large portion of those funds are coming from corporate and public pension accounts, as well as endowments and foundations funneling their money.
This is Judge. May I interrupt for a moment?
Absolutely.
Hello. Because I'm on the phone, as is the treasurer. Are you using the PowerPoint now? Because I don't know what page you're on, if you're using it. It sounded like you went through the first couple pages, but now I've lost where you are.
Okay. I'll try to make that more clear. I apologize for that, and I apologize for not having page numbers on the handout.
This is page
the first pie chart page.
The first pie chart page. Titled TIMO Investors, and it has a pie chart.
Yep. Right. I found that. So you've already gone through the ownership of who owns the land, and then you've gone through. Okay, I see where you are now. There's a pie chart with the big blue part for public pensions. Okay. Go ahead and just let us know when you change. Thank you.
I will. Yep, thank you.
They click.
All right. So we're good on this page. All right, next slide. REIT, the other part of the timberland investment ownership that I described earlier, REIT is a real estate investment trust. REITs are a little bit different than TIMOs. REITs do actually own the land. They are publicly traded companies. They report returns and dividends and such to Wall Street on a quarterly basis. The typical REITs that folks may be most familiar with include Plum Creek, Potlatch, Rayonier, and Weyerhaeuser. Plum Creek used to be the largest timberland owner in Wisconsin for a number of years. They've been slowly selling their ownership largely to the TIMOs. Potlatch had about 75,000 acres in Wisconsin for a few years in the late 2000s and has since sold that acreage to TIMOs as well. All right, next slide. Wisconsin Timberland transactions. To give you a little bit of an idea of the acreage that's involved in this TIMO and REIT transaction world, in starting in about 1999 was the first major transaction with the TIMO entering into Wisconsin. And then over the years, averaging, you know, 10 to 20 to 30,000 acres a year or more of ownership changing hands between TIMOs and REITs. The 2002 bar that you see goes up to about 300,000 acres is the Plum Creek acquisition of the Stora Enso lands. And then they held on to that along with some of their other ownership to about 2007 when they started to sell some of that off. Just to give you an idea of the amount of acreage that's out there in trading hands between these entities.
Is this representing sales and purchases?
It's a sale or a purchase where a TIMO was involved as either a buyer, a TIMO or a REIT involved as either a buyer or a seller. There are likely some other smaller land sales where they may have sold to a smaller party or something like that that we wouldn't have captured in our data, but give you an idea of the breadth of the transactions here and the time frame from which it was occurring in. So what does that look like on a spatial scale? The next slide, Doug, the map. The Steigerwald managed lands in green, this is about 300,000 acres that we manage right now for TIMO clients in Wisconsin, and you can see the interspersed nature along with the BCPL land. We'll look a little bit more closer at these ownership patterns a little bit later on, but just to give you that kind of geospatial feel for where things are at. Tomahawk, where our office is located here in the center, Hayward is our other office, and then Lake Tomahawk being also noted on the map. The BCPL field headquarters. Timberland as an investment, then, to dig into that a little bit deeper, information from ECREIT, which is the National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries, a mouthful nevertheless, ECREIT publishes a quarterly timber index return based on information from properties acquired in the private market for investment purposes. A fairly widely used and cited source. Information here shown from about 2005 going forward. You can see the dip with the economy downturn in 2008 and 2009 and 2010, and then the rates increasing since then. Last year's return was about 10.5% in 2014, combined of two different components, and we'll talk more about what this means as we go forward as well. In that 10.5%, the rate return consists of about 7.5% price appreciation and about a little bit under 3% of actual income return. So those two different components weigh into that return measure for timberland investment, and we'll dig a bit deeper into that going forward here. All right, next slide. Timberland value components. Two areas to look at here investing in timberland. There's periodic income, and then there's asset appreciation. So periodic income, typically two primary areas where that's going to occur. One is timber stumpage. That's the one most people are probably most familiar with. That's the sale of standing timber to loggers, to independent timber producers, to mills, as they buy and pay the landowner for the right to harvest and market that timber. That's that periodic income that rolls in.
And Matt, this is Doug, and that is our major income source.
Correct, Doug.
Yeah, the only revenue source on BCPL land at this time is the timber revenue.
Right, exactly.
So the next slide, then, also timberland value components and periodic income, is land sale. And that's really the other option for timberland owners who have a fairly extensive amount of acreage, and it occurs fairly often and fairly routinely that these landowners are looking at opportunities to sell small parcels that either have a highest and best use beyond their capacity to produce timber. Those might be lands that are more higher in demand for, let's say, large parcel recreation or waterfront or something like that, where that value is simply going to be higher than growing trees. They're also looking to shed lands that are not suited for timber production. Lowlands or other areas that are not forested that aren't going to meet those investment rates of return goals.
And again, this is Doug interrupting, but that's exactly what we've been doing. Ever since we got permission to sell and buy land, we've been consolidating and we've been trying to get rid of parcels that were isolated and finding a county or someone who wanted to buy something. So we've been doing that.
The image on the right-hand side of this slide is a snapshot from our website. We have a real estate division that lists and brokers land for our clients. We have, I think all of our TIMO clients have a number of parcels listed through us for sale, and they vary from 40 to 80 acres to, I think these are 160. Very common for our TIMO clients to look to be selling some of those lands. They're also looking for opportunities to acquire lands that may benefit for access or blocking or along those lines, but we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. Sticking now to the income side of things and the value component. So those are the two sources of periodic income, stumpage, land sales. Also looking then at timberland value components to the next slide, value appreciation and timber product appreciation. This is value appreciation where the value might not be recognized periodically. It might not be dollars coming in per se, but it is value of that real estate that's being accrued over time, recognized through an appraisal process. It is part of those returns that I mentioned earlier. So one way this happens is in value appreciation or timber product appreciation in a given tree. The left-hand chart is an example of, let's say, a sugar maple tree. The bottom line is the increase in value of that tree as it goes from an 8-inch tree up to a 20-inch tree if that tree remains a pulpwood product. If it doesn't enhance in product value, this is just the escalation essentially from the tree growing, maybe a little bit of stumpage price increase, but that's just that value if that product stays low-quality pulpwood. The idea for foresters is to really do what we can not to grow these trees, but to grow these trees instead. Same tree, but here we have different product price appreciation. 10-inch category, we have that tree moving into boldwood category, into small log. When we get up into that 14-inch size class, we're talking about veneer grade, and you can see the increase in value jumping from there to there and some additional increases as it improves the veneer grade. That's value that's accruing and appreciating on the stump. These are the trees we want to grow. These are the trees we don't want to grow. To give you an idea, I'm sorry.
When you say it's the same tree,
it's the same size tree.
Oh, okay.
It's the same size tree. I apologize for that. Same size tree, but different product, different quality. If the chart on...
Actually, now I'm confused. I thought I understood, and now I'm confused. You're talking about the same species in a tree, and you're simply talking about what happens as it changes in diameter in terms of its value. What's the difference between those two lines? I mean, I understand that value is the difference.
What's driving the difference?
The difference in two lines is what kind of trees they are, whether they're pulp trees or whether they're timber trees.
Yeah, pulp or saw log or veneer producing trees. It is a matter of what that product from that tree will be as it's harvested and merchandised.
But it's the same species.
So the difference...
What are you doing that's changing the trajectory of those two lines?
Well,
am I asking the wrong question?
No, there are no wrong questions.
Yeah.
So if I'm not clear, please keep asking it.
Yeah.
Let me...
Same question.
It's an important concept to understand. Let's go back and look at this tree growing from 8 inches to 10 inches. So let's say that tree is sugar maple. When that tree gets to be 10 inches, if that bottom 8-foot piece is reasonably clear, it's a good, solid, sound piece of wood, doesn't have a lot of branches on it, doesn't have a lot of rot on it. That 8-foot piece, that bottom 8-foot piece, has the potential to go to a mill, to go to a market where they can saw it up for pallet stock. If it's a nice, if it's a lousy piece, it's deformed, it's crooked, it's got some rot or something in it, or a lot of branches, they're not going to be able to saw that. So that 8-foot piece, instead of going to the bulk market, is going to go to the pulpwood market. So that's the differentiation in price here. This is if that tree just continues to be only a pulpwood producing tree. All the products in that tree can only go up to the pulpwood market. The lower value product, sumptuous monies are lower, and they're not going to increase in value. The only increase in you're going to get is just you just get more of the same thing.
How do you control that? Or you don't control it, you just find trees and just want the pulp one down.
It gets into the science and the silviculture of forestry a little bit, and depending on the different forest types that we're managing. But there is a selection process in a stand of northern hardwood, for example. When the forester is going out and looking at what trees to harvest, they're looking at the tree to see if it's a pulpwood tree, if it's got the potential to produce saw logs or veneer or higher value going forward. They may choose to allow that higher value tree to stay on the ground, grow, increase in value, and then at the same time take this competitor, this own this pulpwood producing tree, take this out because we know that 10 years down the road it's not going to be worth that much more. Let's get from it. Let's focus the growth occurring out on that site. A forested acre is like an acre of corn. It's going to grow so much.
This is Doug. Is there any chance that you've gotten away from the microphone? I'm having trouble hearing.
You are right on. I did walk away from the microphone for a second. I was pointing to the wall, so.
Okay, but to me, this chart is very obvious. It says that if you've got sort of low-quality trees, you might as well harvest them at 14 inches or so, or maybe 16. If they're high-quality trees for lumber, then you're going to make a lot more money if you wait till they're 18 inches or more.
There is a timing consideration there.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Okay, and I'm sure our foresters are aware of this, and when they go out and mark trees, they know how to do this.
It's a pretty fundamental skill for foresters.
Yep, right. Thank you. Go ahead.
And then the chart on the right-hand side is just to exemplify a little bit more of that change in value. If you look at a saw log producing tree, if you look at that hard maple line in the middle here, and Doug, I'm just going to walk away from the microphone for a second, but down here is the lower grade saw log, $300 and some per thousand board feet. That's the lower grade saw log. We've moved above the pulpwood category. We've left that, but now we're into the saw log category. If you move across to the left as you go through the mill, select veneers and different grades of veneer, you go from that $375 per thousand up to in the neighborhood of $2,500 per thousand, almost a sevenfold increase, just by paying attention to what product we can produce that tree and recognizing which trees we want to be growing out in the forest.
Can you tell before you cut the tree down which of those categories this might land in?
Mostly. There's always the there's a buyer and a seller here. So the seller always thinks it's worth more and the buyer always thinks it's worth less. But for the most part, everybody should be reasonably on the same page. There can be some interior consideration, the size of the heart, for example, that you might not know until you cut it down that might impact rotary veneer where they're spinning it, peeling it, and get down into the heart.
Mm-hmm.
If it's dark or discolored, it's not as high quality.
Right.
But
thank you.
Thank you. Theory.
I'm
okay. Now, next slide then. Continuing to look at value appreciation. If we look at what happens as far as product in a tree, as that changes, we'll pull back a little bit and we'll take all of those products and just roll them together into what we call a cord equivalent. That washes out the whether it's a pulpwood or whether it's a boltwood or saw timber. And we bring all that back together and let's just look at what's happening in the stumpage market in general. So we're talking on a court equivalent price here. A couple different sources of data here that's available to look at this. The easiest sources come from the state land. Starting back in 1995, stumpage prices are somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 to $20 per court equivalent. And that price, if you follow the trend, has generally been an upward trend through 2014. You can see there's ups and downs in the various sources. You can see the BCPL data, the purple line, the top line that's a little bit more jagged. And you see a little bit more movement up and down here because there's not as much volume there as coming off of these other, significantly larger ownerships. So it's more impacted by that product mix. But in general, that line probably trends a little bit higher than the other state lands, for example. But the point I wanted to make is that typically we expect that stumpage market to increase just in price escalation alone.
Why is it so? The fact that the BCPL line is trending a little higher than the others, that's an indication of good management? Or what is that?
Could be a number of different things. Could be good management. It could be timing of the sales. It could be the lands that that are being harvested. There's a number of factors that impact what loggers will bid to procure their stumpage.
Hey, Tom, this is Matt Adamczyk. I guess the point it seems pretty obvious. I mean, we're comparing, we have 70,000 acres and the county has, like you said, millions. Obviously, when we have a single sale in any given year, it's going to go up and down. And our spike graph, I mean, I look at 06, I'm assuming that was after one of the larger purchases we made. We probably had a very large timber sale. So, I mean, I think it's pretty important to note that it's, ours is like, as you said, ours is much more, the variables are much wider than the other ones because our volume is way, way lower.
But the line generally trends above all the other lines.
This is Doug. Yet, to my view, and of course I've been on the commission for this the whole time that this chart shows, and I've been up there a couple times and walked around with our foresters, and I think that they just do a very good job, and they've been able to get good prices in our land sales.
Yeah, this is Tia. I just wanted to comment. I've been on this job a good long while before I realized the volatility that we would be seeing and it took me a minute to understand it. John Schwartzman explained to me that because we had a smaller land base and because of the way by which you rotated through a land base to set up a particular timber sale, you're always going to see with a smaller landowner that larger volatility, if I understand that correctly, and Tom's nodding his head. But it is interesting to note that we are above the average line in terms of stumpage prices. John, is there anything you want to say?
Yeah, I think I can explain why we're above, and that in the sense that for a long time we haven't put an investment into our timberland to get to that point where a lot of our trees are on that previous slide where they're growing into the saw timber. So there is an actual investment that goes on, and we've been doing that investment. And secondly, the time frame from 2004 to 2007 is when we had hit the market at the right time. It was partially a timing issue and a quality issue. Log markets were very good at the time, and we had some really bigger timber sales from our well-blocked land that brought it really good prices at that time. And then subsequently, as Tia said, there's other timber sales that came through our schedule and our cycle that were from smaller tracts and had prices that were not as good, and then you can see where it went down again, and now, it's going back up again. But that's basically how I would explain that graph.
Thanks.
Okay. Then we'll move on to the next slide. Also, an additional timberland value component under the value appreciation category would be timber growth. And this is occurring every day. Timber volume accrues on the stump generally about 2 to 7% annually. Those are rough numbers for Wisconsin, depending on a number of different things. That growth occurs in harvestable size trees, merchantable size trees, as well as the younger pre-merchantable size trees, like this aspen stand, for example, putting on great growth, putting on a lot of volume, appreciating in value, all on its own for the most part. So again, foresters are looking at whatever they can do to make sure that we facilitate that growth to be closer to the 7% rather than the 2%. Everybody's familiar with those radial rings or growth rings on a tree. We need those growth rings to be as wide as they can. So we're looking for things like matching the right timber to the right site, making sure that we're managing for that, and watching for other impacts that may slow growth, because that value is appreciating on the stump. All right, the next slide, also timberland value components, value appreciation, land value. Another one of the components that would fall into that 10.5% asset appreciation that I mentioned before from the NCREIF data. The two charts here, the a little bit different level of data, I guess that's the best way to describe it, and a few different conclusions that can be drawn. The chart on the left, much more broad data, more all-inclusive from the USDA. I guess my takeaway from that would be forest land acreage generally increasing in price. We'll see some trends up and some trends down a little bit. Again, the dip in 2010, a little slight climb back up and a dip here in more recently in 2013. If you drill down a little bit into the data, look a little bit more closely at it, as we have on the right-hand side, a little bit smaller area, and sales where our folks are actually looking at them and saying, well, this may not be an arm's length transaction. This was categorized as a forest land sale, but it's really not. So we've done a little bit of filtering, I guess, if you will, to look at what it looks like on a little smaller scale, a little shorter timeline. Again, similar kind of a run up in the mid-2000s, and then a drop down as the economy has turned down. And then since I would say since the spring of 2014, we're starting to see more interest in the forest land real estate market. Largely referencing here forest land, recreational land sales. Most of the information is coming from 40s and 80s and 120s. Just I think the point here being is that that general market does over the long term show some appreciation. We are in a period where we're going to see a little bit of fluctuation, in my opinion, partially from sellers hoping that they can be back here somewhere in the mid-2000s before things turn down. Buyers still a little bit uncertain about economic terms and not able to get themselves back to the pre-2009 era prices. So a little bit of a up and down there on the real estate market. But the overall idea is that over time, there's that appreciation in land value along with the other value components of timberland.
So, hey, Tom, this is Matt. So would it be safe to say that land back in 2006 was worth quite a bit more than it is today?
If the two parcels were exactly comparable, the market was higher in 2006 than what it is right now. I think that's fair to say.
You say, I mean, I know you don't have it up there from the last 10 years before that. Would you say the 10 years before that, you know, generally it was just like a steady increase, or were there these ups and downs like there kind of is now?
I think it would look similar to what you see on the left-hand chart from 98 to 2013. I think you'll see some run-ups a little bit, and then I think you'd see some kind of flattening periods. And just from personal experience, my brother bought a 40 in about 1980, and I think he paid a pretty high price for it. It was kind of at the peak of the market at the time. So
okay.
I think you'd see the same kind of short-term ups and downs a little bit, but general upturn over that period would probably follow pretty much the trend line shown on the left.
Gotcha.
Doug here. Just out of curiosity, these sales that these charts indicate, that sales off what land?
These are mostly all transactions of land categorized as forest land, staying as forest land.
But is this the land that you manage?
This would be information coming from all sellers and buyers.
So it would include the land from our sales from our land.
It could include BCPL sales.
Okay.
It could include private to private sales. It would include some of the T-mill to private sales. The whole gamut.
Okay, and only in the counties that are listed. Okay.
Hey Tom, this is Matt again. And then looking at the Wright County, obviously that's the more condensed few counties, kind of where our lands are. So going back to 06, the average was my thing's a little blurry, but looks like it's about 2,100 an acre. And then so going down to 2011, it dipped to, is that 1,400 it looks like?
Looks like about 16. I think the very bottom line is 15.
Oh, okay. Sorry, kind of blurry, but. I mean, so obviously it's not just, obviously there's quite a bit of fluctuation. That's only from 06 to 11, that's only 5 years.
That's a fairly significant downturn in the market over that period.
So that was a bad 5 years, basically.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, in theory, we shouldn't have been selling in 2011 at all.
Ready to move? All right. Okay. One more timberland value component onto the next slide. An additional value consideration that we hear often about timberland investments beyond the unit appreciations that we've talked about is that timberland investments are often considered for portfolio diversification in part because they how they behave versus other asset classes. They're often seen as a hedge against inflation, and they statistically will show a low correlation with other vehicles like stocks and bonds. So that kind of risk management part of portfolio is where a lot of folks see timberland come in. We see folks looking for geographic diversification within their timberland portfolios as well. If they own a lot of land in the south or the northwest, for example, southern pine or western softwoods, they may be looking specifically to the lake states to diversify within their timberland portfolio as well. So that diversification, that risk mitigation is another component, another timberland value component. All right, shift gears and move ahead here a little bit to the next slide, the timberland outlook. That's the crystal ball part of this is, well, I've kind of shown where we've been, where are we going to go. Great question. I wish I knew. I think a lot of people wish they knew. I can point to a couple indicators as what folks look at when they try to answer that question. So the housing market is obviously a big driver for timber prices in the U.S. and globally. The chart on the left, the solid area on the bottom is housing starts up through about 2008. That's the area. It doesn't show up, but it's everything below this line, our housing starts. The top line, the green line on the top, pine saw timber prices, southern markets, but a good example nevertheless. Generally, these prices are going to follow housing starts. That's what that's showing. The middle line through here, or the bottom line, I should say, this gold, that's chip and saw, which is material that's going to go into largely fiber markets. So we all know paper markets haven't been the greatest in the last several years, so that type of fiber isn't going to follow housing starts quite as well as saw timber. So the idea that, you know, we're tied to that market in some degree. The bar chart on the right-hand side looking at housing starts going back to 1991 with the dip in 09 and then a little bit of a climb up in the 10, 11, 12, and 14 13 and 14. I think I have heard a number of projections on where housing starts are going to go, and I don't think we've hit any of those projections as far as how many starts they were anticipating in the next year. You see an increasing trend in pretty much everyone's outlook, but how fast we get there and to what level we get to, no one's really sure yet. But our timber prices are tied to that market. A couple of the other markets to look at, mentioned paper consumption a little bit. Well, the feeling is there that paper use is obviously going to continue on a downward trend. As shown here in the blue line on the left-hand chart on the next slide, the Timberland markets, Timberland outlook. Some folks are saying that that market's going to come back around in 15 or 20 or 25 years. I know that's a long time out for me to think about, but that's a long projection. The other part, though, on that fiber side of things, the packaging part of the business. We have a mill in Tomahawk, Packaging Corporation of America. They're doing great. Packaging is a good place to be right now. All of those boxes that Amazon uses to ship out all those products. Good market for our wood right now.
I recently toured that mill. It was a remarkable operation with these large rolls. They're making corrugated boxes. I think they go down as rolls and they're turned into boxes down in Texas. And the first for shipping out of the Southwest.
The newspaper print and the fine magazine paper, those are going to be tough markets for a while now. But we're seeing a lot of our mills shift into different products and shift their manufacturing away from that type of paper. And the mills that can do that, I think there's some reasonable optimism there. Another one of the markets to look at, the American hardwood exports. This information from the USDA, first three quarters of 2014 shows a continuing growth in global exports of American hardwood products. Increases of 22% in value in comparison to the same period last year. So that's a significant part of what we do here in Wisconsin is growing quality hardwood. Our northern hardwood resource, which is one of our most common forest resources, that sugar maple and basswood and yellow birch and anything that we can grow into a log like we were talking about before, that's a significant resource for us. Somewhat unique to the Lake States and New York and Appalachian country, but it's one of our strengths, and the idea that that market is going to be there, I think it's a good luck side.
This is Doug with a question that has had some controversy, but I can't resist. Have you guys looked any way at the effect of climate change on this hardwood market? Because hardwoods prefer a certain climate compared to warmer climates.
That question for me, Doug?
Yes.
This is Tom. Well,
right. I mean,
let me try to answer that for you as long as it's asked. Climate change to us fits in one of those categories of mindfulness with regards to impact on the forest resource. So whether it be emerald ash borer or gypsy moss or anosum, or short-term or long-term climate change, those are things that we monitor and pay attention to with our amount of energy devoted to what our assessment of the risk is. Does that come close to answering your question, Doug?
Well, it's a complicated question, and we don't have lots of time. I was thinking more about the fact that as we have warmer winters and either more drought or more rainfall, how is that going to affect the quality of different tree species, particularly the hardwoods, which are valuable? And again, you can certainly tell me that you don't know, and I would appreciate that. It's complicated.
It is complicated, and it's hard to point to a specific occurrence where we can say this is a likely outcome or not a likely outcome. From a management perspective, our approach is to try to make sure that our forests are as vigorous as they can be, knowing that if they are, they can withstand better some impact. If we
right.
already have another stress from another source, that puts us at further risk.
Yep, I got it. Okay. Well, I'll let you go on now. Thank you.
How much of the demand for northern hardwood forests like you manage is local, Wisconsin-based or Midwest-based, versus export?
I don't know the specific numbers on that. I know that our stumpage markets are impacted by the export markets. When the export markets are good, we'll see it. We'll feel it all the way down
okay.
to the guy out there choosing which tree should be cut. Having said that, Wisconsin has a very large secondary manufacturing timber industry that utilizes a lot of that product. And obviously, that's the best-case scenario if we can utilize that product locally rather than putting it in a container and shipping it somewhere.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll move on to the next slide then. A quick wrap-up of the investment side of this before we move on to the management practices. This is information that I actually gleaned from a team of website, Timber Investment Resources, and I thought it was a good quick summary. It paralleled most of what I had talked about, so just to recap here quickly, some pros and cons with timberland as an investment asset. Just to run through those, historically, the returns have been good and competitive. I mentioned the comparison to other asset classes and the mitigation of the risk with that, some diversification. Biological growth, we talked about that a little bit. That's growth that's occurring and value appreciation that's occurring that's independent of the other financial markets. Those trees are going to grow. They grew the same in 2009 as they did in 2002. Independent of the market. That's value appreciation that's happening there. Timber harvesting can be adapted to timber price movement, so there is some flexibility and timing considerations there for property managers. We can watch those markets, and we can choose if those markets are low and we believe that they're going to come back, we can choose to hold that resource for a little bit. We have that timing option. Long-term market fundamentals indicate limited supply. What they're saying here is that they see globally an increase in demand for fiber products and also an increase in pressure on timberland, increase in pressure on timberland for other uses other than growing trees. So they see a decreasing supply of fiber and an increasing demand globally, big picture. And the socially responsible investment, I think that's part of what some folks look at, is where their monies are going to be invested. And if they want to feel good about where those monies are going, investing in timberland that falls under a certification program that's certified as sustainable forestry through a third-party certification, that's a feel-good investment for a lot of folks. Some of the cons, and there are cons to timberland investments, it is not a liquid asset. It takes some time and investment to get into, and it takes some time and some investment to get out of. Market timberlands can be thin. What they're referring to here is in parts of the world where the infrastructure, the markets, the buyers, and the sellers are not as developed as they are in most parts of the U.S. This is a pro for Wisconsin. We are in good situation here for our markets and infrastructure right now. Certainly there are risks, and there's a lot of discussion about what those risks are, but generally comparative to the global scene, we're in good shape here in the Lake State. It is a long-term investment. Timberland is. A lot of those value appreciation elements that we're talking about, it takes a number of years, it takes some investment, it takes some time to be able to realize that value appreciation. And then the last item referenced here, this ambiguity to the exact market value, what they're referring to there are those items that I had talked about that were value appreciation but not value income, real estate value, stumpage value, timber growth, product enhancement. Those are all values that have to be appraised. So there's an appraisal behind those to say it went from point A on January 1 to point B on December 31st. That's the ambiguity that they're referencing.
This is Doug speaking out. When I went through this PowerPoint this morning, and I went through this carefully, it looked to me, fortunately, like the cons don't apply to us very much in the sense that we aren't in a hurry as far as liquidity, and we are in it for the long term. I mean, we've been doing this for over 100 years. So it strikes me that that's good news for us, that the cons are not that applicable to our management. What do you say about that? Does that make sense?
Well, I think the cons are valid to recognize, but I think I would agree that you have an asset that's certainly manageable with opportunities in place. It's a little bit different picture, I think, if all of us were sitting in a room talking about whether we wanted to go out and buy 75,000 acres as opposed to the fact of we have 75,000 acres. How should we move forward with that? Okay. Let's move on then to management practices, best management practices. I'm a forester. I'm not an economist, so this is more fun for me to talk about. Even though the economist side of this is really the nuts and the bolts, that part has to work in order for us to get to this part. But this is how we make that economics part of it work as well. So best management practices, BMPs, that's a term that comes up in forest land management. I've kind of categorized it in the two different areas to help think about what those might be. The environmental side of things, this is a natural resource feature that we're managing. And then also management practices that fit kind of that, and I'll use this term loosely here, fit that kind of fiduciary responsibility to manage an asset for a return. So the next slide, best management practices for environmental. Just listed off a few things here to give you an idea of what folks like John and his staff face, what our foresters face, whether it be public lands or private lands. For the most part, it's the same across the board here in the things that we have to consider. Water quality, certainly being one of those. Wisconsin has a field manual for best management practices for water quality. Invasive species, that's been a big one lately, and we're certainly certainly an issue in the southern half of Wisconsin, starting to become a much bigger issue in the northern half of Wisconsin. There are best management practices that have been published for the control and management of invasive species for timber management. Biomass harvesting, certain harvesting techniques that may have the risk of impacting site productivity, such as biomass harvesting, where we're looking at removing a lot of the fine material, the twigs, the leaves, the small branches that otherwise might recycle into the nutrient pool, that's coming out for hog fuel and other sources or other biomass type things. What's that doing to our site productivity long term? Best management practices for that as well. And then I think most folks are going to be familiar with the idea of threatened and endangered species and natural heritage features such as natural communities. All considerations when we're looking across the natural resource, across the brand of broad landscape in factors that we need to consider when we're operating on that landscape.
What's the natural community?
Loosely areas of unique biotic fauna and flora. I don't know that this would be one, but you might consider a oak savanna or a pine barrens or something like that.
You need to consider when you replant there, keep that character.
Yeah, I think the idea is that those are portions of the landscape that exist in such a small, limited area that if there is the possibility to manage around that, or perhaps complete some management that might encourage that type of ecosystem that could occur. It's not a big feature for most timberland or property land or property owners for sure, but just an example of one of the things that
you
keep it.
Have we gone on to the next slide?
I was just going to say something about oak savanna. Oak savanna is a natural community that is extremely rare in Wisconsin. I think what Tom was saying was there are instances where there are rare communities where you would either want to preserve the features of that community, or if you were going to manage it, enhance those features. And the reason I was in a conversation with people about the challenge of restoring oak savannas. So I guess there isn't much of a balance. So I think what you were saying was there are places where you identify rare communities and you seek to protect or enhance those communities through your community.
Yeah, but I don't know how much time you need. This is Doug. How much time you need to spend? Have we gone on to the next best management practices site or not? But like I say, I've been on the board for a long time, and I've visited with the foresters and talked with Tia and with previous executive secretaries. And my impression always was that we were doing very good best management practices. For example, when we found that we own land that probably should be preserved for some reason because it had endangered species or whatever, we've been selling that land or trading that land to DNR so DNR could manage it in a different way rather than manage it for timber production. And we've been very careful to do our harvesting in the winter when the land is frozen and et cetera, et cetera. I won't go through the whole thing. But I'm of the opinion that John and his people, and even before John, we're doing a very good job, and Tia, to her credit, has made that even more of our program. So I think we're good on that.
Yeah, just one point of clarification. When I came on board 10 years ago, we had a biotic inventory that identified these rare natural communities. We prioritized the sale of those communities to the DNR, which is better suited to manage for those features because we're in the timber business. So the vast majority, we sold about 13,000 acres, and about 10,000 of them were natural area quality land that we got rid of in our portfolio, transferred it to the DNR to a sale, used the proceeds of those sales to buy timber-producing land. That was and that partnership with the DNR is largely wrapped up. I think they bought everything they wanted on the list, but one parcel.
Well,
maybe.
90%
yeah.
They bought.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, let's move on. I have some time constraints. Thank you, though. I don't mean to be too difficult.
No, we'll move on. We'll move on, Doug. So continuing to the next slide, then, best management practices, looking a little bit more at the forestry side of things now, the forestry practices for activities that would occur across the timberland landscape. I'll go through these fairly quickly, but all things that John and his staff, again, are fully aware of. Forestry generation, growth, and vigor. I mentioned the need to monitor, to focus, to assess, to continue to evaluate threats and risks on this part of the forest. It's what the forester is looking for driving home at night. It's what he's seeing driving to work in the morning. It's what he's thinking about when he's eating his sandwich in the truck. Unauthorized use and boundary issues, unfortunately, they do come up on any large property. Timber theft occurs, sometimes intentional, sometimes not intentional. Best prevented by being active on the property, by having foresters out on the ground, by paying attention to where your property boundaries are marked, by knowing what your neighbors are doing, when they're harvesting timber, what roads they're using, those types of things. Public use, whether they're private or public lands, there is going to be a certain level of public use. There will always be. November is a great amount of fun for us because that's when the phone starts ringing about what roads can we use, where can we drive our ATV, when can we put a deer stand up, what kind of deer stand can we put up, somebody else put a deer stand, where my deer stand is, what are you going to do about it? All of those calls come in part of timberland management. Woods roads, a huge investment for forest land owners. Those are the capital private roads, the gravel, the ditching, the maintenance, the gates, the berms, everything else that goes into protecting that investment, a large consideration for property managers. Market awareness and timing, I mentioned a little bit of that recognizing that there are timing issues in the timber market and what can be done and what can be prepared so that we can take advantage of those. Real estate sales and acquisitions, that there is a normal amount of activity that occurs with folks calling about asking if there are lands for sale, monitoring whether adjacent parcels might be coming up for sale. It's something that our foresters are doing routinely. Kind of that bluebird what we call bluebird phone calls coming in. And that's just the normal level of activity without a landowner objective for either to either focus on buying or selling. And then inventory and planning, a big part of what has to happen to make all these other things worthwhile. The most expensive part of timberland management is putting a forester in a pickup truck and putting him out in the field. So we like to emphasize the need to do the reconnaissance, do the field work, do the inventory work, get it done well, get it in-house, get it into a geographic information system so you can do a lot of your analysis, planning, and monitoring in-house. And from what I've seen of the BCPL lands GIS, I think it's a good system. It's a good solid foundation to build off moving forward. There's a lot of information I've seen that's been provided to us just to take a very high-level look at this resource.
This is Doug with a question that I can't thought about as you were going through that with roads and things. Some of our land does not have legal access or does not have a road that you can get to. So how does land that have no permanent legal access, how does that affect the value? How much less are they worth, and are they hard to sell?
Doug, we've got a couple of slides coming up here shortly where we'll talk about some of those property characteristics. If I could defer the question to then, if you can hang on for a few minutes.
Okay.
If you need to click off here, let me know. I'll make sure to answer that before you do if we don't get to it. But it's coming up pretty quick. So just to wrap up this, then, timber volumes, that's really an asset. And an accounting that starts with standing volume, has a process to add in growth, and has a process to deplete harvest volumes, that kind of continual timber volume. It's good to know, it's certainly valuable when you come around to an appraisal process if that's part of the valuation. And then budgets, we're normally working with our clients on what our annual budgets are, what our costs are expected to be, what our revenues are expected to be, and to be able to get to that point, all the information that I mentioned in those couple bullets beforehand is critical. So just a couple of the day-to-day things that John and his folks are working through, as well as anybody else involved in timberland management.
This is Doug with another question about that. Our board has discussed some in the last some meetings about the question of the cost of our management in the northern office and looking at the budget, and some of us have wondered if it's money well spent and how much should we spend. And I think what you've just said, without talking about details, is that it may take more staff and more money to manage it than a non-involved person like me might think.
Yeah, and we will talk a little bit more in detail about costs coming up here as well.
Okay.
But, yeah, to briefly answer your question, you know, living in this on a day-to-day basis, there are a number of things that probably happen that most folks, unless they're going through it, may not recognize. But we'll talk about costs a little bit more. I'm prepared to dig into that subject as well. So we'll kind of leave the broad area now and look a little bit more specifically at the BCPL lands. And what we've done here is taken the information out of the GIS system that was provided to us and just try to come up with a couple of quick comparisons to the lands that we manage. So you can get a feel for where it is similar and where it may be different. The characteristics that we'll look at here: forested versus non-forested, upland versus lowland, blocking and access are a couple of the key characteristics that in an appraisal process an appraiser might do an analysis on to determine value. And that all relates back to the profitability, the operability of the property. So the Steigerwald managed land in green, and this is most of that ownership that I showed you on that earlier map. Approaching 90% forested, where the BCPL lands are a little bit over 70%. So those, it's in forested, I mean it's growing trees. Nothing fancy about that. The other areas are just going to be open uplands, open lowlands, marsh or whatever. They're just not growing trees. I'm not going to differentiate between whether it's productively growing trees or not here. I'm just talking about acreage that's forested.
This is Doug again. When I went through this morning, what I noticed about this chart was why we have a problem selling some of our land. You know, we've tried in the past to sell land or to make trades for land, and you see how much lowland we have. That lowland, in my opinion, from my visits and experience, is not very saleable. Am I correct about that, or have I missed something?
No, the upland-lowland consideration is important here. Lowland sites for our forest lands in Wisconsin are much less valuable. They're much less productive. They have significantly more difficult operability constraints, and they're also typically forested with tree species that we don't have real good markets for. So that lowland percentage, whether it's forested or not forested, has implications on overall production, I guess, timber production and returns, I guess, if you will. So, and that value is certainly recognized in a large part of the forest land market, that those lowlands are a challenge.
So someone would not want to buy our lowlands for forest production, or they might not want to buy them in order to put a house on them.
Both, yeah, significant limitations there.
Okay, thank you.
So the uplands on the lands that we're looking, that we manage, close, probably about 75% to 80%, the uplands on the BCPL lands in the mid-40s. So a fairly significant difference there.
If we go on to the next slide now?
We are now on to the next slide, Doug.
The one that has a map of Wisconsin?
One that has the map of Wisconsin on it, yes.
One thing I noticed in the very first of your presentation, it showed that you guys managed some land down south of Portage County, and that is not on this map. It disappeared.
It did disappear, yes. And actually, for the folks that are looking at the hard copy, I have a little bit different image on the screen right now, and I'll describe what that is, and then we'll shift to the map, and I'll explain why you're only looking at a portion of that. The image on the screen shows the BCPL ownership, and it shows a similar size ownership up in Douglas County, Douglas, Washburn, Bayfield primarily. So this is the extreme, and I just wanted to put this up here to show you. This is the extreme. That ownership up in northwest Wisconsin is about a little bit over 70,000 acres, extremely well blocked. That's a really strong attribute for that ownership. You can put a forester in a truck, and he doesn't have to spend a lot of downtime driving from site to site. Loggers, they don't need to load their equipment up on a lowboy to get to the next harvest. They just drive down the road. A lot of great value there. But that's really unique, okay? And I didn't think it would be appropriate, obviously, to compare that with your scenario. So a little bit different way to look at that, and this is the map now that we're looking at that's in the PDF. I just grabbed a snapshot of about 175,000 acres of one of our owners that exists typically in the core area. So I thought it was maybe a little bit more average, if you will. The blocking in those central lands, Doug, probably a little bit above average to the high side, but I thought it would be more fair to compare something that I thought was maybe a little bit more average.
I got it.
But even given that bias towards that process, the lands that we manage, on average, the contiguous tracts are about 900 acres in size. The BCPL contiguous tracts about 150 acres in size. A pretty significant difference there.
Yeah, but I'm looking at both maps now, and I can see what you mean about how you selected lands of yours that are more similar to ours. I got it.
And this is information that comes from John and his staff that we thought about. I talked to our folks about, does this pass the sniff test? Does it seem reasonable to you? And everybody said it does. BCPL reports stumpage values of 10 to 35% more for timber sold off of larger tracts. I think we talked about that a little bit earlier, why that may be, but I think that's a good thing to point out here of where that is.
Just for the commissioners, I'd point out that the Esri software that just got relicensed is what made it possible to provide this data to Tom. And while the data is collected in the field for cover types by the Lake Tomahawk office, that database is maintained by our information technology person, Mike Krieger, who has special training for this purpose. And it would not have been possible without Mike.
So here's a question that comes to mind. You're doing comparisons of our land to the land that you manage, but can you make a comparison to the way that the county, because a lot of county forests are intermingled with ours, and in the past we have actually sold and traded some land to consolidate with the county forests. From your knowledge, are the county forests more productive than our land or less productive?
I'm not sure I can answer that precisely, Doug, as far as how productive they are on an average acre, for example. And there are a number of different county forests across the northern, you know, half of the state, so I think it would be hard to say offhand. From a blocking perspective, though, just knowing a little bit about the county forests, I would think that the math would show that their block size is higher, but I'm just wondering,
we've talked sometimes about whether we should try to transfer all of our land to the counties in which it resides and let them manage it. And I don't know a lot, I don't want to be criticizing county government, but my impression has always been that our foresters who focus on our land do a better job than the county foresters who don't quite focus on it as directly. Now, every county may be different, but that's why I asked the question.
Yeah, I couldn't weigh into either way on that one.
Okay, thank you.
The next slide, looking at access, the Steigerwald Timberland characteristics looking at access. So we went through the green lands that I showed on the last slide, the portion of what we're managing, did a GIS analysis, what percentage of these lands have direct road access. And then we used information out of the BCPL on which of those parcels have direct road access, which we looked at, and it seemed to be reliable. And the map is kind of that image of what that looks like. The green and the blue lands on the top, those are our lands. So the green are the ones without road access. And just visually, you'll see that the blue appears a lot more evident than the green does. And the numbers convey that as well, with over 90% of the lands that we're managing having public road access. And then
this is Doug. I kind of jumped ahead, I guess. But this was the slide that I looked at this morning that led me to my earlier question about the value of land with or without access. And I was maybe surprised, and maybe that shows I wasn't paying attention enough, how much of our land really doesn't have access, and therefore why, A, people don't want to buy it, and B, it may not be as easy to manage.
Yeah, both valid points, Doug. Thanks for bringing those up. There are some easements for the BCPL ownerships which don't show here, which would provide some access. There would also be some easements on our lands that do not show here either. But easement is good. It's better than not having access, but it's not the same as road frontage either. I just wanted to point that out. To your question, Doug, about what does it mean for value, that's a really good question. And I can tell you our brokers hate getting requests from landowners to sell land that's landlocked.
Right.
It's a challenge. And it's a challenge for our appraisers, too, because of the market for how those transactions occur. There are some landlocked parcels that you can sell for a little bit of a reduced market price if an adjacent neighbor has some interest and isn't extremely strong-armed about what they will pay for it. Those sales do occur. On the other hand, there are parcels that are landlocked that I don't know that we could hardly even give away. So, you know, what's the number? I don't know. It's hard to say, but it's a significant impact on value if there is no legal access.
And the other thing I noticed on this slide is how many little teeny-weeny parcels we have scattered everywhere.
Yeah,
all those little purple dots must be 40 acres or something.
The smallest dot that you see on here is probably a 40.
And we've got a lot of those that do not have access, which is, I think, part of the problem. I asked about this several years ago when I was up north, and I was told that that's why we can't sell this land. We got small little pieces that nobody can get to except the birds and the skunks.
Yeah, just for the board, we have 31.5% of our land has what is classified as having a management impediment, and that would either be no legal access or a 40-acre parcel that's scattered and with an economically insufficient amount of timber to manage for timber production. So close to a third of our portfolio has a management impediment. Either due to size or lack of public access.
Well, this is Matt. I'm looking at those same 40s, and I guess my question would be, if we can't sell it very easily and we're not really management, in some ways does it matter? It just sits there, correct? I mean, it's land we own that we can't get much for. I mean, it's got some value. Somebody would want to buy it at some point, but we're not actively managing some of these 40 acres, correct?
John?
Some we do. Some have harvestable timber. Sometimes we are able to negotiate with landowners to get access. So there are opportunities, and when the opportunities arise, we take advantage of them.
Yeah, but I mean, as a general point of what Doug was saying, we do have quite a few of them because these are holdover lands. I mean, you know, I mean, obviously they're not that easy to sell, but, you know, in some ways it's just land we own. It's not that big of a deal.
The one other point that gets missed sometimes is that even though you're not actively managing a piece, you need to touch it every so often to verify that someone else isn't doing something there to make sure that you're not going to incur, the Attorney General's laughing here, that you're not going to run into an adverse possession claim. And so having these scattered pieces, even though you may not incur active management expenses on a day-to-day, you do have to get out there regularly to touch it just to keep an eye on what else is going on around it.
So we have one section left then to talk about management costs and then a quick summary. But before we go on to that, just to wrap up a little bit about these property comparisons that I've mentioned. And I think folks have kind of touched on this as the discussion has gone through. But you think about the maturity of the evolution of these different land bases. The lands that we're managing for our TEMO clients, I'm sure that a lot of that acreage goes back into the 1800s for folks that have acquired it and actively managed it for timber for a long, long time. And each successive landowner goes through that process of how do we make it a more efficient, profitable land base? Where do we look at selling lands? Where do we look at consolidating? Where can we negotiate access? Where can we get rid of stuff that we don't have access? On the lands that we're managing, that process has been active for a long, long time. And I think potentially the BCPL lands are a little bit more immature in that process. So I just wanted to point that out. I think that origin of how we got to where we got here is a point to consider. Okay, winding down here, timberland management costs. A couple points. Obviously, a function of a number of variables. I'll give you a figure when we're done here, just to understand there's a lot of different things that go into what that cost is. level of management, activity, type of the resource, how fragmented it is, all those types of things. The costs that I'll mention here include all the on-the-ground costs, the foresters' costs, as well as some of the administration and the overhead. So the rates that we've come up with, those are our charge-out rates, are based on our labor rates, what we bill our clients. That includes our trucks, our mileage, our overhead, our admin. It includes our ESRI license. All of those things that we incur, that's all got to be transferred through our per-hour rate that we charge our clients or whatever fee structure we're using. So it's all in there. And it's going to fluctuate with annual activity, forest inventory work, and some of those other features along those lines. The annual activity, I mentioned before the timing option that's out there. It's not unusual to do a lot of field work, set up a timber sale in a given year, and then not sell that timber sale in that annual period. You may choose to hold it back, or you may choose to sell it in the way the markets are right now, a 2 to 3 year logging contract. That logger may not make his final payment on that stumpage until the next year or even the following year, even though you have incurred all of those costs prior to that. So it's not like a normal business where you have costs and money in and money out in a very short time frame. So there is that variable in there. Forest inventory work, landowners sometimes choose to do those differently. The idea is generally about 10 to 20% a year, so you're back into the site at least once in 10 years. Some landowners do it all and then don't do anything for another 10-year period. Some do 10% a year. There's just a number of different ways they look at spreading some of those costs out. The rates that I'll mention or the figures that I'll mention exclude property taxes. They exclude other fees, appraisal fees, for example, or fees that might be paid to a broker for commission for land sales. So those are not in there. And then the bottom line is what I will tell you for the most part. We would expect management costs for these, as I have described them here, to fall somewhere in that $3 to $6 per gross acre per year. And gross acreage is total owner acres. It's not forested acres or productive acres. It's just total tax or deed acres, if you will. So that's the number that we come up with. If we had an appraiser who was going to do an income approach and an appraisal process, and they came to me and they said, Tom, what should we figure in here? I'd say use 450 an acre if it's average. If you think something else is going on, tweak it above or below that a little bit, and you'll be pretty close. So that's the number for what it's worth. Okay, last slide. Thanks for sticking with me through this.
Tom, can you go back one?
Well, this is Doug, and I read over the summary, and if I were to try to skip to the bottom line, given what this board is charged with as our duty and our discussions recently, my question is, in your opinion, do you think the ownership of timberland, our timberland, because that's what we're dealing with, is an appropriate investment for our institution, such as us, at the present time, because that's what we face as quote managers. As you know, we manage money, and we manage land. And anyway, so what is it appropriate for us to manage this land, given the fact that we're trying to provide funds for the trust?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, I guess, that's in front of everyone in the room here. I'll answer that partially for you, Doug. I don't think I can answer it completely, though, because of the depth of the level of the information that's required to answer that. So, in short, I would, from what I know of the charge of BCPL, timberland is an appropriate investment, and I think it's a good investment for a lot of the reasons that we have talked about here. It is no doubt challenged to meet returns that would be expected of timberland as an asset. I think largely a factor of, as I had mentioned, where this ownership is in maturity as far as having worked through some of the processes that are typically in place to make them a profitable and productive timberland. So I think it's a good discussion to have. I think timberland is an appropriate asset for what I understand BCPL's structure and charge to be. What to do with this specific property, this acreage, and whether it fits or not is, you know, not a question that I can answer based on my objective here and my scope, which was to provide that background information for that discussion.
Right. I've got a couple other questions, if I can. One is, as we saw, and it was one of my biggest concerns when I went through this morning, we have a significant amount of land that is isolated, and it's small, isolated, and not very productive. Do you have any recommendations on how we can maximize the value of those assets?
Off the top of my head, the first thing that comes to mind is to actively look at those. The options are, not do anything, continue to do what you've been doing, which, as John mentioned, is, you know, kind of an opportunistic approach, or consider a much more active approach. I think all of those should be looked at to see what the outcomes would be. As I sit here this afternoon, my bias, and this is more personal than anything, is to be more active than passive.
More active doing what? More active trying to get access to cut timber, or more active in trying to sell them?
Yes.
Yes to both. Okay. Let me ask one more question, and I apologize for this, but I may have to leave in a minute here, given something that it's not your problem. There's a bill in the legislature that would take away our authority to purchase land. And I've been in the commission long enough that I was on the commission for many years before we had the permission to buy land. And it always was a pain because we couldn't consolidate and things we wanted to do. Then we got that permission. I think unanimously the legislature gave us that permission, and we actively have been using it to consolidate land. And John or Tia could give you more details than I can about how we've used that. And all I know is it was to our advantage. What do you think the impact of that legislation would be to the value of our trust lands?
I'd like to answer that by looking at the last bulleted point on the last slide in summary side that indicates that successful timberland requires a full set of tools for a variety of issues. And as a property manager, anytime I have that flexibility restricted, I would have concerns.
Okay. Well, I think, and that's the reason I brought this up, and there's no reason we should hide it from us. The three of us are our commission that work together, and is that there is some feeling that we should or shouldn't take a stand politically, because this is politics now, on that piece of legislation. From my experience that I just talked about, I would be against it, because I've seen how effective it can be for us to sell a piece of land and then purchase another piece of land that was more within our framework of asset management. So I would be against it. Don't be offended, gentlemen. I don't think the other two commissioners have had as much experience, obviously, because they're new. And that's why I wanted you to kind of give us some guidance about whether that particular tool was valuable and we should not lose it.
Yeah, I would simply follow up to say that, you know, those are policy level decisions and decisions for the board to discuss. My weigh in with my comment was from a timberland manager's perspective, and I think that would be a pretty common response if you were to ask any forest property manager as far as, you know, the need to have the ability to be proactive and flexible, take advantage of situations when they arise. Whether it's timberland or in any management scenario, I think those are at least in my experience, in my professional experience, have been important. So the more we
thank you.
Tom, this is Ted Adamczyk. First of all, appreciate you giving the presentation. I mean, as you gave it for a presentation, I mean, one of the things that I realized is, you know, we've got three commissioners. I mean, I definitely feel knowledgeable about this topic, but obviously none of the three of us are specifically foresters. This isn't what we do every single day. I mean, part of my general problem is, I mean, that I believe our Constitution is quite clear that we've been charged to sell all this land, and now we've got three people in the three current commissioners that are charged with dealing with all this land. And I mean, it just, you know, I look back, I guess I have major concerns. I look back at 2010 is the year we lost $500,000 when we looked at overall management costs plus, you know, the timber management costs from what we actually made in our timber sale. One of the things you mentioned is that companies do is that they make two revenue streams basically on a yearly basis, their timber sales and then also their, you know, some sales of smaller parts of the land. Well, we don't do that. If we do sell land, they buy new land immediately. So we're not actually capitalizing that. So I guess my general question that I'd ask you is I'm a big believer in looking at all options. Obviously, Steigerwald Land Management does this for hundreds of thousands of acres now. Is our parcels of land, our 75,000 acres, is that something, if we decided as a board, and obviously this isn't your decision, could your company or other companies possibly manage our land for us if that was something we decided to do?
Thanks, Matt. With regards to that question about, you know, private sector management of public lands, traditionally I haven't seen a lot of it, at least in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're all land managers and we're all foresters, and I think we look at clients and listen to clients to try to understand what their objectives are and meet those objectives. So I don't want to be here today to pitch.
No, I know that's not your job.
Decisions for you or our services. To be straightforward and answer your question, I would imagine it's a scenario. I wouldn't be prepared to talk about the pros or cons of that right now.
Okay, thank you.
Because this is Doug, the obvious second question, which you don't want to answer, I understand why, would be, if you were managed on land, would it cost more or less than having John and his guys manage it?
You're right, Doug, I can't answer that.
Right, I knew it. I just wanted to put it on the record.
Yeah.
I'll put one thing on the record as well. Obviously, this isn't Tom's job to put this forward today, but I can tell you that I don't think there's a single company out there that would manage land where they're losing, spend $800,000 in a year to bring in $300,000. I mean, that just boggles the mind. So, I mean, it's obviously not, that's a commissioner's decision. So we can move on and talk about other stuff.
We're in a little bit different situation than the other landowners because they bought land in about accessibility, thinking about productivity as they made investments, where we have land that we've just been slowly over the years getting rid of selling what we could at a reasonable price. But some of the land we have that's landlocked, I think Tom used the phrase, we can't give it away. So then the alternative.
Alrighty. How are we doing? I need to go pretty soon, but I'd like to hang on because it's my responsibility.
I'm okay to move on.
Okay.
Tom, I had one question from the second last slide when you talked about that.
We're not moving on, or who's talking? Was that Commissioner Schimmel?
No.
I'm sorry, this
Go
is
ahead,
Tom. I have one last question. In the management cost section, you talked about $3 to $6 per gross acre per year, excluding taxes, excluding appraisals. Above it, you talked about fluctuating with inventory work. Is that excluding inventory work, or is the $3 to $6 including it?
The $3 to $6 would include a minimal amount, but
okay.
It's a very likely scenario that some extensive inventory work, if it needed to be done or was lumped into a certain period, would certainly exceed that.
Okay.
So the kind of day-to-day, you know, maintenance and updates probably in there, but a lot of information, but you are 10% or more, and that's going to push it towards that higher range for sure.
Yeah.
There were a few points on the last slide here in summary, and I think we have reasonably covered these through most of the discussion with regards to the recognition of timberland as a potential investment asset, the unique management considerations and practice considerations of that as an asset, the historic evolution of the BCPL lands I think I touched on, and the challenges and the opportunities there to work on those challenges, and then the last point was what I had referenced with regards to the discussion about the selling and buying land and the legislation that's out for that. So I guess with that, I'm done. but otherwise, happy to answer any other questions or participate as
director. Thank you very much. I learned an awful lot. I appreciate very much your time.
This is Doug. Thank you. That was a very thorough and informative presentation.
Yeah, this is Kathy. Thank you as well.
Tom, knowing what you know now, would you have a recommendation for us going forward?
Which, can you refine that a little bit?
Yeah. What would be the most? What do you think would have the most value for us in assessing how we go forward and improve the value and revenue performance of this asset?
I think the first thing that comes to my mind is the information that there's, or the knowledge that's needed to make that decision. Is, you know, what can be gained if the decision is to continue forward with a land bank type authority process? You know, I said those landlocked parcels were worth potentially next to nothing. You know, that's my comment here as we stand here today. But, you know, in reality, there's thousands of acres out there that may or may not be true for. I don't know, and I don't know if there is an answer to that right now without looking at them and doing the due diligence to say, maybe these aren't as bad as we thought, or hey, here's an opportunity that you didn't see before. So that's what comes to mind first off, is in order to answer that question, there are some more questions that maybe need to be asked and answered. What's the potential gain? And if we go through that process, and what's the timeline to go through that process, what can we accomplish in 3 years? What can we accomplish in 5 or 7 or 10? And what's our willingness to work on that for that amount of time? And then what bang we get for that investment? We could go through this process. We could sell all these lands. We could try to enter into the market. We could try to buy more land. We can work on improving access. We can work on improving productivity. But how much, I think, is a question that could be answered with a little bit of effort.
And what would that effort look like?
So we'd have to, I was going to ask the very same question. So we'd have to retain someone to do that due diligence. That would be...
Well, you could certainly do it in-house. You could, you know, secure folks from the private sector that could help in portions of that with offered opinions. Or you could look to a consultant to, you know, complete a project for you along those lines. If those questions were laid out, it wouldn't be something that, you know, would be foreign to folks that are working in the industry.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you all for your time. And
thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about what we all do on a day-to-day basis north of Highway 10 and 29.
Thank you, Tom. Have a great trip back.
I had to leave for a minute, but I'm back. I'm sorry.
All right. I was just wondering if we still had you. Okay.
So where are we now, Brad? I'm sorry.
We're on to item 6 on the agenda, which is the discussion and vote on the WSLCA summit.
Oh, that's my favorite item, huh?
Okay, so there's kind of, it appeared to me from the last, from our discussion at the last meeting, there are kind of two issues. One is members of the staff here attending the conferences, and I think the other issue was whether commissioners should attend the conferences. Is it fair to break it out that way and kind of discuss those as two separate issues?
Well, again, as the old-timer, I would say yes, and there's two different questions. I think it's appropriate for a commissioner or maybe even more if they were interested to go to represent us. The way these things work, at every meeting, a representative of the state, and it's been me often, stands up and gives a report of what we're doing in Wisconsin or what they're doing in South Dakota. And that's a very useful session. It lasts for several hours. And I think having a commissioner there to represent us is appropriate. If there are agenda items that fit particularly to things that one of our staff members would benefit from, then I also think it would be good for that staff member to be allowed to attend. So it's kind of split that way. Does that make sense, Brad?
Yes.
Matt, I just make one quick point. Last time, the graph dropped off that was on the last time this conference was up here, the bar graph that showed all the lack of land we have in comparison to every other state, Arizona had almost 10 million acres, us at 77,000 or whatever. This one they threw on there, a different one for the money we manage. I guess one thing I would make a complete comparison, my understanding, let's say we've got the 968 in the Common School Fund, that's the big fund. Remember, a lot of our money is managed into our trust fund loan program. As far as I remember, a couple of years back, it was up to $800 million. Well, that's a completely different program. I don't think almost any, no other state has our program. It's a state specific program. And it's simply a simple lending program. I mean, I don't know how much we need Doug or anyone else to have some conference talking about it. I'll be very clear. I have no support for sure the commissioner is going. I won't be going. I don't support anyone else going. That's my opinion. I don't expect Tia to go. On a case-by-case basis, if there's a single staff member that needed to go, and I'm assuming it's Rich, I guess maybe, but I'll say that's my piece. I don't support anyone going, really.
Well, I understand that, and you put out a statement about me and going, and I'd just like to clarify what I saw there. In my request to be allowed to attend these meetings to represent Wisconsin, you pointed out that it costs $25,000 for me to go, but that's over about a 9-year period. So that's sort of like $2,000-something a year. And that expense is really very small compared to the fact that we earn somewhere around $30 to $35 million, which we give to the schools. So I think that the cost of going is really a very minimal cost, and I think it's worth us being represented.
Well, I mean, at that rate, we make $30 million a year. I mean, maybe we should all go on a trip down to Florida. It doesn't matter that the numbers are small. The number that was put before us today was a commissioner of $1,565. If you go on two trips a year, that's $3,000. I'd much prefer to give that money to the school kids of Wisconsin. That's my opinion on it.
Okay, and I understand that, and we can disagree and still talk to each other.
Can someone tell me a little more about the conferences, what happens at them? And as I understand, there are different segments that might be useful for Rich, might be useful for Tom. What?
Yeah, I haven't gone much in recent years. I've only been once in the last few years. I went to the Phoenix conference, as I think you know. And we alternate staff depending upon what the agenda is. So there are 24 members of the Western States Land Commissioners Association. There's over $70 billion in school trust funds, and they're managed in different manners, but there's a lot of similarities about the challenges we have. There's a lot of sharing of best practices. A portion of our trust fund is in the loan program. Another portion is in fixed income. This is not dissimilar from some of our cohorts in the association. So Texas has a lot of oil and gas. They manage for oil and gas. The states that have timber, they manage for timber. Of the 24 member states, 19 of them have a permanent school trust fund. So we have our differences, but we have similarities in that we are all managing a permanent school trust fund, and we're managing our assets for a constitutionally established beneficiary. And the agendas vary, and it depends on the agenda. Typically, the agenda is what determines how I decide, or in consultation with Tom, which staff person to send. In this case, I would very much like Rich to go to this particular meeting, because as the board considers converting from Chapter 24 list of potential investments to a prudent investor standard, 15 of the 19 permanent trust funds, I sent this email out today, I had Rich do this research, are using that investment standard. I would like Rich to go, and one of the great things about the conferences is not just the formal sessions where experts on trust fund management, for instance, present, but the informal opportunity to gather and share information, and I'd like Rich to work on compiling some information on that prudent investor standard. And there's a particular value to the conferences that I think Tom better articulates than I, so and it relates to the legal aspect. Tom?
The Board of Commissioners of Public Lands is a unique entity in Wisconsin, but these land commissions are not unique in the western part of the United States. When I got to BCPL, the first thing I started doing was looking at the laws that impact us. How do we fit into things? How do things work? And I have to say that the greatest source of information for me was the Western States Land Commission, because I got to sit down with the lawyers from all the other land commissions and find out how these pieces play out in these different scenarios. I'm a big fan of not reinventing the wheel. If I can learn from somebody else how they skin their knees, that is of great value to me. And so when I go with an information shopping list, and I have never come back disappointed. I think it's a great resource.
And this is Doug, if I can answer that question, because I've gone to a number of conferences. There are some sessions that are not of any value. The good thing is they often have two or three sessions at the same time, and you can pick the one that fits Wisconsin. I don't go to the oil and gas things, you know, for example. But here's what I've discovered over the years. I have gone to a few Secretary of State conferences, and Brad, I'm sure you've gone to at least one Attorney General conference and maybe a Governor's conference, so you know how those function. After doing that and going to a Western Land Commission, I decided quickly to stop going to Secretary of State's conferences as far as the value. And I found there was a lot more value, a lot more interest that applied to what I cared about here in Wisconsin at the Western State Land Commission. So I've been going to those fairly regularly, and I've not been going to the Secretary of State's, which I think are a lot more political fooey, if I can say that. These Western State lands are not political. They talk about the issues and what's going on with their land or with their different assets.
Are other constitutional officers at these conferences?
Occasionally. The reason that is occasional is every state is structured differently, and we are somewhat unique in having these three commissioners. For example, in Texas and in Arizona and in Washington State, they and in New Mexico, they elect a land commissioner. One person is elected, and they often come. In the states like, for example, Montana, where they have a board of five commissioners, the governor, the auditor, etc. And in those cases, they often do not come. They often send the equivalent of TIA who to represent them because they're often busy. Sometimes one of them will come. I mean, the treasurer will come, or the auditor will come, or the secretary of state will come. I could go on in more detail, but that's a quick answer.
This is Matt. One last quick point, a point I made the last meeting. We don't have the land mass that these other things do. You mentioned Texas. I mean, Arizona, on their website last year, on their land, they brought in $318 million. We brought in $0. Our holdings are much smaller than many of these states. At the website, the thing that was given to us today, Texas has $34 billion in their holdings. We've got what, less than $1 billion. And again, a lot of our holdings are very simple. We did the trust fund loan program, which is at least half of our holding currently, and it's gone up to 70-80% of it. And then the only other investment we're even allowed right now under the current legislative structure, at least that BCPL is using, because we don't use it, the SWIB or whatever, is the in-state municipal bonds, which are simple bonds. So, I mean, you guys do whatever you want. I've made it very clear I have no intentions of going. I don't think Doug should be going. I don't know what we need to keep talking about here, but I'll keep listening.
I'm compelled to send staff to this. I think that we should continue that practice. I think Tia made a particularly strong case for Rich attending this year because of a potentially big move that we're about to make and how, in what investment standards we use. So I'll make a motion that Tia be able to designate a staff member to attend. As she indicated, she intends it to be Rich, but I make that motion relative to that part.
Well, I'd second that so we can move on.
Okay.
I guess Matt would not second it.
Yeah, I mean, I won't be supporting it either way, but
okay.
I have much less concern if Rich ended up going.
Let's keep moving here to get us going. I'm sorry.
I'm fine to vote.
Okay. Have we exhausted the discussion as to that motion?
Yep.
Okay. Then all in favor of approving Tia to designate someone to attend the summer conference that's coming up, say aye, and I say
yep.
Aye.
You left out the word staff.
Designating staff or herself or Doug? Because that's another big difference.
A member of the BCPL staff, Tia, or some member of her team.
Okay, so the motion does not include commissioners.
Yeah, that's not what I intended on this motion.
Okay, I just want to, you worded it a little differently, and I wanted not to have a confusion. So I vote aye as far as Tia sending an appropriate staff member.
Okay.
And I'll vote no.
Okay, so we've resolved that motion. Then the next issue, as I've divided them out in my head, is the issue of whether a commissioner should be funded through BCPL funds to attend. And is there a motion on that?
Well, I mean, again, I've made it clear that I think it's of great value. It doesn't have to be me. Let me explain. It has been me historically because, A, I have an interest in forestry and environmental issues. It's also because the Attorney General is very busy, and I've worked very well with many attorney generals of both parties, and they often don't want to go because they don't want to be away from their duties, and they usually always attend the attorney general's conferences, and I don't attend the secretary of state conferences anymore. The state treasurer has sometimes gone, but not too often. So that's why it's been me, and I'll be honest, I think I've been useful at those meetings. So I'll make a motion that the that I be allowed to attend that July meeting just to see what happens.
I guess to Doug's point there, I mean, I obviously, I mean, these are trips. I mean, what, this one's to Utah, the last one was to Phoenix. I, as a person, of course, would want to go on a trip, but I just, this doesn't seem like a useful use of our money. We're supposed to be looking out for our beneficiaries, and I just don't think this is a good use of our money to send commissioners to it. Obviously, Doug and I agree on it, so obviously I won't.
Follow the rules of parliamentary procedure. I'll second Doug's motion so we can officially.
Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah, I know. And that's fine. I think there's a lot to be said for Tom's point about learning from what others are doing, and not every state is the same as ours, but even though Texas has a bigger trust fund they're managing than we do by quite a bit, there are still things to be learned, and other states don't manage more timberland and things, but I'm not as compelled on the utility of sending one of us as commissioners. We are like any other board. We're managers. It's the staff that does the day-to-day operations. It's the staff that reports back to us on what they believe are best practices. I'm not as compelled on sending a commissioner. I know, Doug, that it's something you've done, but I think there's a good point to questioning what limits we put on this. I would be more inclined to send a second member of the staff than to send one of the commissioners. We have our other jobs. This is just a small aspect of, well, it used to be a small aspect of each of our jobs. So
this is Doug. We disagree, and I have a feeling how you're going to vote, but I think it has been important and useful for us to support this organization and to send someone in leadership role. And during the different programs, when I've been there or someone else has been there to represent Wisconsin and to attend the executive committee sessions, And to vote, I mean, I have to vote every time on a number of issues that come up. I think it's useful to have a person of authority, if you will, rather than a staff person. And that doesn't mean I don't respect our staff people, but they are not in that kind of leadership role. And I've been to enough of these meetings that I know that everybody else also appreciates that. They appreciate that we are willing to send a significant leadership person to these meetings. And again, it's a minimal amount of money, as I pointed out.
I suggest then that we send two staff members. I mean, that's just where I think the money would be better spent having our staff go out and learn this. So I...
Can you just move with the vote then here?
What? I'm sorry?
Yeah, I mean, I completely just disagree with Doug. I mean, that's... I'm sure he believes it's worthwhile. I just think we save the money. And I think, I mean, no offense to Doug, but I mean, if there's a voting going on out there, I don't think I'd want you voting for me. I doubt we'd share a lot of opinions. So, I mean, it doesn't really matter. I just think if at this point you guys have authorized seemingly Rich to go, I think that should be fine for the summer.
Okay. Any other discussion on this?
I couldn't understand that, but it's not important maybe. I just heard my name mentioned.
Okay. I don't think there's any. There was nothing in it, Doug, that I think you couldn't predict. So
I'll
discussion. I'll call for a vote then.
I will try to read Matt's comments in the minutes.
Okay. I'll I'm gonna call for the vote on the second motion. Then all in favor of BCPL funding for Doug to attend the conference. Say aye.
Of course I say aye because I made the motion.
Okay. All opposed?
That's me, no, Matt.
And I'm going to vote no on this as well.
Okay. Then we've got routine business number 7 is future agenda items. And, of course, we've got till noon on Tuesday next week to come up with any other things. So then 8, Executive Secretary's report.
Yeah, a couple of quick things. We were in at a meeting on arena financing last week. Tom, I think, got most valuable player award for that meeting. I think we're in a position to help them cross the finish line. There's another meeting tomorrow. It's still a moving target as to who the borrower is and precisely what role BCPL plays. But we are playing a useful role in the discussions, and we will continue those discussions tomorrow in the governor's office, chaired by Eric Schutte. We're up in joint finance on Thursday. I am going to Oneida County on May 13th at their invitation. You guys may recall from a previous board meeting that in 2009 we offered all our land in exchange to Oneida County to get outside their project boundary and turn our land over to them. They voted that down. The politics changed, as I reported to you guys at an earlier meeting. We went back to them, John and I, recently. They'd like us to come before them on May 13th. Matt, it's my understanding that you and Senator Tiffany have put forward an alternative proposal and that you've been invited to present on the 13th. Is that correct?
I told the gentleman up there that I would likely call in. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Can you tell the board what your proposal is?
Nothing specific other than the fact that pursuing all options, including possibly having counties work with us to possibly manage our lands like we've been talking about. I guess I'm a little confused as to why you or John are going there. I mean, first of all, John's probably 20 minutes away. You're in Madison. What would you be going up there to talk about? I mean, my understanding is it's continuation as normal. What are we discussing?
The county board invited me to present our proposal for the turning over our lands to the county.
Seems like a simple proposal, but that's fine.
Well, they've asked me to present the proposal, and they apparently asked you to present the proposal. The proposal that you and Senator Tiffany put forward, as I understand it, was quite specific. It involved paying the county to overtake and manage BCPL lands and split the timber revenue. At least that's what the county told me, you said.
I think this is a pretty big deal, and I'm inclined to say I would like to have the executive secretary there face-to-face to make sure questions are answered, to make sure that she can come back and report to the commission a really clear picture of what the alternatives are and what the pros and cons of those are. I'm not seeing an issue with her traveling up there. That makes sense to me.
I would think John could handle the questions. I mean, my understanding is we're trying to the concept before was for the stuff that's in our ownership lands inside the county lands to see if they'd buy them, correct?
They are not inclined to buy it, but they may be inclined to trade it, and what we're going to do is discuss the particulars of how a trade might work.
Okay. I've always been in favor of any trade that gets us better blocking of the county land. That's fine with me.
All right. Then anything else in your report, Tia?
No. That's it.
Okay.
I have one other thing, but I can save it for next time because
okay.
It's been a long day for you guys. Thank you very much.
All right, then. At this point, I'll make a motion to adjourn.
I'll second the motion. This is Matt.
Okay. And all in favor, have a nice evening. Everybody opposed can stay on the line or stay here and talk till you're blue in the face. I'm out of here.
Yeah.
Thanks, Matt.
Bye now. Take care.
Take care. Bye.